pounding of hoofbeats across some verdant plain. The sensations were so acute, she quite forgot she was in the dusty old emporium at all. The shop walls simply faded away, until what she could see in the edges of her vision was a wild, rugged vista of green, across which other rocking horses cantered in wild abandon. After that she was tired, but it would not do to go back to the Wendy house, not when the night was still vast. Determined, she set off, ducking along an aisle where lace butterflies had once cavorted on invisible threads. In the insectarium at its end, the shelves were packed with boxes of grubs and larvae. On a whim, Kathy picked up the first, warmed the cocoon inside her palms, and watched as a woolen housefly emerged. Only Casper, she thought, could have spent long hours concocting something so mundane as a toy fly. Papa Jack's were the golden dragonflies and grasshoppers, Emile's the bright furry bumblebees. She left the insectarium by the back door and came, at last, to the carousel in the heart of the emporium floor. The carousel itself had not turned since the night the emporium closed its doors, and its painted horses, its unicorn and stag, now slept beneath blinkers and rough-spun blankets. The depression in which they sat was surrounded by an avalanche of pillows, draped in the same dust sheets as everywhere else. Kathy remembered long winter nights when mothers and fathers had reclined on these hills and watched as their children were borne around by the carousel. Those slopes had always seemed so inviting. Even now, hidden under thick sheets, they tempted her down. She made her way over and lowered herself in. No sooner had the land given way underneath her, moulding to the shape of her body, Sirius reappeared and wormed his way onto her lap. Sandwiched between the pillows and the patchwork, it wasn't long before Kathy's eyes grew heavy. Fleetingly she closed them, content to float, for a time, on a mountain of pillows through the emporium dark. Noises woke her. It was still dark on the shop floor. The first thing she noticed was the cold, for Sirius was no longer on her lap. With the clumsiness of the half-asleep, she stumbled to the bottom of the slope and got her bearings. She could see which way Sirius had gone, for he had left marks in the dust now carpeting the emporium floor, the tell-tale swishing of a hastily stitched tail. He had disappeared into the dark beyond the carousel where the spider-web of aisles had once housed all manner of delights. Panic gripped her. What if, somewhere down there, Sirius had lain down in the dust, his motors winding down? What then of the promise she had made to Casper? Kathy took off. Past the carousel, the darkness in the aisles was absolute. She fumbled on one of the empty shelves, groping blind beneath dust sheets, and came back triumphant with a glass jar in her hand, a relic left behind after the emporium was closed. Fortune favoured her. She screwed the lid tight, and the crocheted fireflies inside turned incandescent. They buzzed against the edges of the glass, and suddenly the aisle was lit up, serpents and soldiers cavorting in the shadows of the shelves. Kathy bore the light to the end of the aisle. She had not noticed this door before. But then there were so many doors in the emporium, and the aisles constantly refracting or being rearranged, it was easy to get lost. And yet, there was something about this door that made her certain she would have remembered it. It was like the door to Papa Jack's workshop in miniature. Oak with rivets of grey-black steel. Judging by the claw marks low down, the patchwork dog had scrabbled inside, and not for the first time. She set down the lantern and opened it a crack. "Sirius, you rotten hound, where are you?" The door opened an inch, then an inch further. The first thing she saw was the dog. It was lying asleep, its feet twitching in whatever dreams creatures of cloth could have. Beyond where it lay, lit up by a string of firefly lanterns on a ledge beyond, Emile Godman sat hunched over a worktop. At his feet were piles of felt, rolls of wire, and a bale of cotton wadding. Toolboxes were stacked against one wall, sandwiched between crates of toy soldiers ready for sale. Kathy had heard of Emile's workshop, but until now had not caught a glimpse. Sally Ann said the Godman brothers used to share a workshop high up alongside their father's own, But here was Emile's, hidden in plain sight among the Emporium aisles. She was whispering, trying to wake the patchwork dog, when Emile released a great cry of frustration and, whirling his arms like a toddler in the throes of some enormous tantrum, cast whatever he had been assembling from his worktop. A hail of wood and fabric arced over the workshop. What Cathy took for a pinewood hard-boiled egg landed square on Sirius's nose, waking him with a whimper. "You wretched mutt, you're no help either. Why don't you go loping after Casper like you always do? Why do you have to bother me?" Sirius beat his tail, whether in taunt or delight Cathy could not say. Emile rushed at him, dropped to his knees and flipped him over. Cathy was about to leap out when she saw that Emile was only roughhousing with him, scratching the fabric of his underbelly and exposing the mechanism dangling there. "Still ticking," he grumbled, shaking his head in disbelief. "And here am I, every night, just trying..." Emile rolled backwards, pulled one of the crates away from the wall and heaved out of it a bundle of rags and felt. At first Cathy took it for more spare parts, but when he set it down she realized it was a sheep, stitched together from old eiderdown and rough-spun blankets. It was cruder than the patchwork cats and dogs that once populated the Emporium shelves, like a picture of a sheep a three-year-old child might have made. One of its black button eyes was lower than the other, its snout not nearly plump enough with stuffing. Emile reached into its belly, wound it up and sat back, teasing Sirius's ears. In front of him, the sheep began to totter. It walked in a circle, emitted a pillowy bleat, bent to chew at some imaginary cud, and continued in that way until its motor had wound down. "Useless," Emile muttered. "It's a toy, just a toy. There's no magic in it. It's just mechanics. Camshafts and gears and four legs, up and down, up and down. What's the difference between you and that? What is it, you silly mutt? Why can't I..." Emile grabbed the patchwork sheep by the hind legs, tossed it back into the crate and slumped once more. "At least I have my soldiers. Casper isn't interested in soldiers, so at least they're mine. And I've got something special, Sirius, lined up and ready for the next first frost." Emile marched into an alcove on the further side of the workshop, disappearing into shadow. Moments later, Cathy heard a chorus of rattles and clicks, and Emile emerged, his arms full of soldiery to line up on the opposite side. Standing proudly among them was his Imperial Capitan. Cathy watched as an army of wind-up soldiers marched out of the alcove, moving inexorably against an army on the opposite side. When they had crossed half the expanse, they stopped and lifted their rifles. Tiny pellets of wood exploded forth on strings, striking the advancing regiment just as they came within range. Under the hail of bullets, the enemy fell. The only man who kept on marching was the Imperial Capitan, impervious to the bullets. "See!" Emile exclaimed. "Casper won't know what's hit him. My riflemen will scythe his down, and nothing will topple the Capitan. The next battle of the Long War, Sirius, is going to be a massacre." At his outburst, the patchwork dog leapt to its paws. It turned to see Emile, but as it did, its black button eyes landed on Cathy. And though nothing in them changed, they were only black buttons, somehow Cathy saw the hint of acknowledgement in the way the fabric creased across its snout. Its tail beat madly, and as it did, Emile looked round. Cathy recoiled back into the darkness of the aisle. She had taken only three strides when her feet, such treacherous things, caught one another mid-flight, sending her sprawling onto the Emporium floor. The shock echoed in her body, but all the same she picked herself up. She could hear footsteps behind her now, but it was only Sirius coming to shepherd her home. More troubling was the voice that harried her along the aisles. "Casper, you rotten spy, I know that's you." "It's against the rules, Casper. Subterfuge and espionage, they're against the rules." Heart-pounding, she found her way back to the paper trees and hurried through the Wendy House door. Only moments later she heard Sirius scrabbling to get in, and after that Emile's voice hallooing through the trees. However intricate this toy was, nobody had fine-tuned its loyalty. It had led him straight to her. She could hear the crunch of Emile's footsteps coming over the picket fence. First, he was cajoling Sirius to get out of the way. Then he was calling out his brother's name. Cathy looked around. In seconds he was going to come through that door. And no matter how vast this Wendy house was, it was still a finite space. Four walls, no nooks and crannies, so very few places to hide. That was when her eyes landed on the toy box. The dull thing of dovetailed wood that Casper had brought on his last visit. The idea occurred in the very same moment that Emile's fingers landed on the door. Cathy threw herself across the Wendy house floor, heaved the toy box out and threw open its lid. Then with one eye on the door, she stepped inside. The floor was not beneath her, not where it should have been. She held onto the edges and pushed herself over the precipice. And then, at last, she felt it, somewhere below. When she stood, the toy box swallowed her up to her waist. The Wendy house door had started to rattle, but quickly she sank down, curling herself into a ball so that only the tip of her head could be seen. Then, as Emile shouldered his way in, she slammed shut the lid. In the toy box, there was only darkness. She could feel the walls closing in on her, the air growing warm and moist with her own breath. Yet, somehow it was holding her. Somehow these four slats of wood had cocooned her in their heart. One pocket universe inside another, just like the child still kicking inside her. "I know you're in here," came Emile's voice, muted by the wood. "Casper, don't be such a fool. There isn't any other way out." For the first time his voice faltered. "Casper?" She heard his footsteps prowling the edges of the room, heard him stop at the foot of the bed as if to check nobody was hiding underneath. By now he would have seen the nursery, the rocking horse and crib. By now he would have seen the collection of Emporium adverts lying strewn across the sheets. The air in here was close. She felt it hardening in the back of her throat. She was cramming her hand into her mouth, if only to keep herself from coughing, when she heard Emile's footsteps moving back in the direction of the door. She breathed out. But the relief was short-lived, for no sooner had Emile passed the toy box than Sirius sent up a familiar howl. She contorted to look upwards, where a tiny sliver of light ran around the toy box lid. Now it was marred by a patch of shadow. Sirius was looming above it, giving her away. Emile's footsteps grew louder as he moved in her direction. Then his hands were on the toy box lid, drawing it up, and, from the incalculable depths below, Cathy peered up into his startled eyes.
"You?" he whispered, and fainted clean away.
It took some effort to heave herself out of the toy box. By the time she reached him, Sirius was lapping at his face with its darn sock tongue, making the most dejected of noises with whatever motors lived in its throat. Cathy knelt beside him, peeled back his eyes. They were still flickering, and no sooner had she closed them than they opened again. As if startled for a second time, Emile scrabbled backwards. Cathy darted around to put herself between him and the door.
"Emile, please, listen, it isn't what you think."
"What do I think?" he breathed, clambering to his feet.
"You think I'm one of those confidence girls come to steal secrets, that I'm selling secrets to Hamleys or that shop on the Portobello Road?"
"Well?"
"Well, look at me, Emile. Just look!"
She had almost shrieked it, for Emile's eyes were darting into every corner, searching out the secrets he was sure she had ferreted away.
"Emile, I have nowhere else. We have nowhere else."
His eyes landed on her belly.
"I'm sorry," he said, berating himself by smashing bunched fists into his sides.
"I didn't think. I thought you'd go home. Why ever you ran away, I thought you'd go back and have your baby there, and then I'd forget about you, and you wouldn't be back, and I couldn't go home. I just couldn't."
"So you hid here, on the day the snowdrops flowered? You've been hiding here ever since?"
It had been on the tip of her tongue to beg him not to blame Casper, to tell him none of this was Casper's fault, but somehow Emile seemed to be making the leaps of imagination for her, the story spinning of its own volition.
"I'm sorry," she whispered. Oh, no, he said. No, no, no. Kathy, sit down, please. Let me. I should never have let you go. I almost didn't. I was going to tell Mrs. Hornung, but I knew there had to be a reason you'd kept it secret, and... I'm sorry, Kathy. You believe it, don't you? Why, if I'd have had the idea, I'd have hidden you here myself. He didn't know what to do, so instead he began pacing in circles, urging her to take the foot of the bed. When she did, he rushed to close the Wendy House door, lest anyone be spying from the paper trees. Mrs. Hornung does her rounds, and Casper... Sometimes Casper creeps around here, concocting whatever he's concocting. You must be careful, Kathy. More careful than you've been tonight. He stopped his pacing, and Sirius, who had been mirroring him at his heel, promptly sat at his feet. How long will it be? You mean my baby? He nodded. Soon, she whispered. My mama was alone when I was born. Only her and Casper, but he was hardly a year old. Our house wasn't any bigger than this. Two rooms and a yard house and hens in the hut. And... You did the right thing to stay here, Kathy. You mustn't do it alone, and I can... You won't tell Papa Jack, will you? Emil puffed out his chest. I've never lied to my papa before, but I'll lie this time. And... Casper? On this, he seemed to ruminate for the longest time. Casper would know what to do. He always does. After our mama passed on, before our papa came back, well, it was Casper who used to catch rabbits for our pot. Casper who taught me how to dig for mushrooms. It was Casper who told me we had a papa and that one day he was coming home. Oh, he didn't believe it himself, but he still told me it every night. And now... Emil came to sit beside her on the bed. Folding his hand over hers, he said, Mrs. Hornung has some books. I've seen them on a shelf. And Papa has his taxonomies, the anatomies he uses for building his dolls. There must be something in there, and perhaps it's best after all if Casper doesn't know. Two can keep a secret, Kathy, but three... It was on the tip of her tongue to say... You already told him I was pregnant. But then he would know that Casper had told her, and know that it was Casper who brought her back here. That did not seem fair. All Emil had ever wanted, was something of his own. Something he could stand alongside and say, Look, this was mine, and I did as good a job as any. So, instead, Kathy squeezed his hand, rested her head on his shoulder and whispered her thanks, while inwardly she cursed her lack of courage. Why had her bravery abandoned her tonight? Even the baby, that half-formed thing inside her, was wiser than this. Before he left that night, Emil gave her a pipe-cleaner bird, the closest he'd ever got, he confessed, to the magics of his father. It fluttered around the Wendy House rafters until all its energy was gone. Then it dropped to the floor, where Sirius gnawed on it with relish. Afterwards, she picked up what was left and hid it underneath the mattress. Secrets and lies, she thought. She had thought she was skilled in both, but in truth she was a dilettante. She was going to have to do a lot better. The Brothers Godman, Papa Jack's Emporium, 1907. Consider Casper Godman. Tonight, if you are the kind of emporium obsessive who collects a catalogue each year, whose home is infested with silver satin mice, who has saved and saved your pennies in the hope of one day taking a runnerless rocking horse of your own back home, you would have found him in his workshop, unwashed and unkempt, as only a man in the throes of passion can be. Only, you would not have found Casper Godman locked up with an admirer. You would have found him in a storm of balsam, and metal rivets of paints and lacquers and varnish. Around him would be a half-dozen incomplete boxes, one upended inside another. One would be overfilled with patchwork animals wound down and piled high. Another would have half a bedstead poking out. Yet another would be splayed open around Casper Godman's waist, as if trying to devour him whole. The peripheries of the room were couched in the patchwork animals he had tried to make. A mermaid, meant for a good girl's bathtub, lay half-beached on a shore of wound-down patchwork bears. Caspar had thought he would devote his summer to making patchwork so lifelike there was not a difference between his and his father's own. But there was a higher calling, and he slaved for it now. He pressed his hands against the innards of the box in which he was standing, thinking he might shift its edges back just one more inch. But the wood began to buckle. The slats came apart, and instead of standing inside his cavernous vault, he stood in a disaster of splinters and jagged shards. Still, he did not abandon his calling, nor lament the world that was doing him wrong. He sat for a while, in the middle of the destruction, and gaped. Even in failure, what a life this was! He picked up one of his joists, slotted the broken shards back together, and laughed. What a blissful way to spend your hours, your days and nights, making things up because nothing else mattered. He was about to take another turn, but something stopped him. At first he thought it was his hands. They were too tired. His whole body was spent. Then he realized it wasn't his hands at all. It was his head. What inspiration he had to achieve this. The thing that had first driven him to cobble the slats together and start teasing out the space inside. It was the girl, down there in the Wendy house, waiting for him to come back. The smile she had given when he stepped into his toy box, the way her face had crinkled, trying to resist her astonishment. And yet... What he wanted, most of all, above even beating Emile in the next round of the Long War, was to take a completed toy box down to Kathy and say, "Look. Look at this thing I have done. You think it's only my papa who achieves the most vivid of Emporia magics. Well, not anymore." It was the girl. He realized now that he was doing it because of the girl. By the time he careened across the shop floor, he was more convinced than ever. Kathy had never made a toy in her life, but she had opened something inside him, some untrammeled desire. Caspar had never lacked inspiration. No toy maker could have made his paper trees without it. But this was different. He had never lacked shop girls to tell outrageous stories to, nor even to get lost with in one of the Emporium's many nooks. But this was different, too. Being the best had always been important. But only to be the best. Being the best for somebody else, well, that was special. He stopped as he hit the paper forest. His papa's magic mirror was hanging here, showing some corner of the Emporium storerooms where its sister mirror hung. He stood in front of it. His reflection imposed upon that shuttered room full of boxes, crates, the ranks of twitching skeletons waiting to be draped in patchwork, wound up and released into the Emporium playrooms. He was not, he had to admit, the most handsome sight. He made some attempt to style his hair with the tips of his fingers, straightened his shirt sleeves and the velveteen waistcoat he always wore, it did not do to wear common plaid, not when his work was so important, and proceeded, pausing to pick paper wallflowers on the way. Before he went into the Wendy house, he peered through the window. And there she was, Kathy Ray, perched on the end of her bed. Her belly looked markedly bigger than it did even 3 nights ago, but it was not there that Caspar was looking. He was looking at her eyes. Kathy startled when the door moved, both hearts inside her leaping in fright. Her heart only half stilled when she saw that it was Caspar, for wasn't there every chance Emile might come trotting behind? Caspar looked more bedraggled than she'd seen him, yet still held himself with a peacock's pride. Kathy marched past, slammed shut the door, and wheeled around. "Where on earth were you?" she demanded. "I beg your pardon. You used to come every night, and now..." "Am I to understand that you miss me, Miss Ray?" It was a question Kathy was determined not to answer. "And yet..." "I do," she replied, angry with herself for admitting anything so foolish. The truth was hard to articulate. Emile was company enough, distraction from these Wendy House walls. But somehow it wasn't the same. Emile brought his worries, but Caspar brought his wonders. "It wouldn't have taken 10 minutes to come to the shop floor just to..." "I'm sorry, I've been selfish," I'll say you have. Have you been very bored?
Yes, she thought. Boredom had been part of it, but there had been a meal, and now that she pictured him, she did not want to be unduly cruel. There was sweetness to a meal, and she hardly begrudged his visits, even when he came to her like a little boy does his neglected mother, to pull on her apron strings and ask, "Have I been good?" She even enjoyed his company. He had brought her books, The Complete Confectioner, being a collection of recipes for children by the indomitable Mrs. Eel, The Nursemaid's Oracle, with advice on rearing and disciplining unruly youngsters, by one William Boole, a sketchbook Papa Jack had made of the workings of the human body. This had more to say about joints and motion than it did the processes of giving birth, for which, Emile declared, there was a copy of Grey's Anatomy somewhere on a shelf, if only he could conquer his squeamishness enough to open the pages. Now that she thought about it, that was more than Caspar had ever done. Caspar was the one to bring her the reams of newspapers the Emporium collected for stuffing and packing, but leafing through them only reminded Cathy how close the walls of her Wendy house were, and what a world there was out there if only she could reach it. London, which had once seemed so far away, sat denied on her doorstep. The front page of the Times showed the royal procession moving along the Horse Guards parade. To think, she might have seen Prince George himself. Lizzie would have died. While inside, announcements were made for summer theatre in Regent's Park, and an advertisement showed ladies in elegant tea gowns walking through Kensington with the air of courtiers. There were only so many times she could read the list of debutantes being presented at court this season without screaming, "I don't care about coming out. All I want is to come outside." "I've been out of my mind." "I'll make it up to you." "How?" "I'll think of something." "How?" Caspar brightened. "You're not denying my ability to think, are you, Miss Ray?"
"Nothing of the sort," she snapped. "And do stop calling me Miss Ray. It's almost the worst thing about it."
"The worst thing about what?"
"About this," she said. "Caspar, don't you think? Isn't it possible I might have been better off if you'd just let me go and find a new home? Because if you're just going to leave me here..." At this, Sirius gave a solitary yap.
"You're upset," said Caspar.
"I am."
"Perhaps you'd like me to leave?"
Cathy ripped one of the pillows from the bed and hurled it in his direction. He took it to the face and did not flinch, the perfect imitation of a man.
"I would not," she begrudgingly declared.
"Cathy," he said more sincerely now, "has something happened? Something untoward?"
"More untoward than this," she said, as if to include the Wendy house, the patchwork dog, the Emporium itself.
"No, not a thing."
She had known, before Caspar walked through the door, that she would not tell him about Emile. Either Emile would have confessed everything, or he would have kept his silence, and she always kept faith with the latter, because Emile had seemed so proud to have a secret of his own.
"Well, go on," said Cathy, with something approaching a mild rebuke. "Tell me what you've been doing that's been so vitally important to the future of the Emporium that you couldn't spare me a single hour." Now that he was mildly forgiven, Caspar marched into the heart of the room. "It's my toy boxes. I stretched the space inside one so that it's the size of a closet. I'm stretching it further, but something breaks inside, something breaks in me, and..." He started gazing up into the Wendy house rafters. Then his eyes dropped back to Cathy. "I'm still unsure how my papa made all the space inside here. But it's near. I can feel that it's near." He did not say, "Every time I see you, it's getting nearer," because how could she understand anything as ephemeral as that? The magic of toys was one thing, falling in love quite another. "Imagine," he said, "a toy box the size of a train carriage, with a switchback stair leading to the bottom, and then another toy box inside that, and another inside that. A boy could own an infinite number of worlds, all locked inside each other. If only I can..." Caspar stopped.
"You're looking at me in that way again."
"I am?" The way that says if I wasn't so charming, you'd have them drag me off to bedlam. She gave him a pointed look, and in return he roared in unadulterated delight. Caspar stayed until midnight, but Kathy had not yet fallen asleep when she heard a different tread approaching through the paper trees. Emil was more reticent than Caspar. He knocked and waited to be invited within. Kathy rushed to the door and tried to bustle him through, but instead Emil stood steadfast on the step between the paper trees. "No, Kathy, I've come to take you out." Kathy looked up. Mottled silver rained through the paper branches from the skylights high above. "It's midnight." "Indeed," Emil declared, "a midnight feast." And on stepping aside, he revealed the picnic hamper he had been hiding. It sat squarely on the roots of a paper oak, opened up to reveal breads and preserves and all manner of other splendid concoctions. Kathy needed no further temptation. She followed Emil through the trees and onto the shop floor. But it was not until they came through the atrium at the Emporium's entrance, past the knight's errant and the rocking horse corral, that she realized they were not really going out at all. Now that she thought of it, the very idea was preposterous. Emil, outside these Emporium doors, was more of a nonsense than Caspar. He simply did not belong. Far better that she follow him through the insectarium, along an aisle where a patchwork menagerie waited, gathering dust for next winter, and on into a depression of land where the aisles pivoted apart. "There used to be places like this all over the shop floor," Emil explained. "But they got retired or they got moved around, and sometimes, if you don't keep up, you get to forgetting where they are. They get trapped behind aisles, or somebody builds a bridge over them, or the toys are placed in such a way the eye rather glances over the spaces in between. Me and Caspar, we used to call them the sometime dens, because they're only ever there half the time. But they're perfect, don't you see, for just not being seen." There was a picnic blanket already laid out, in red and white checkered squares. Emil led Kathy down, guiding her as if past imaginary holes in the earth, and invited her to sit. "May I?" Emil began. Kathy nodded. Emil opened up the hamper so that the moonlit picnic could begin. After the plates, knives, and silver spoons, he produced a pair of chicken legs, roasted to perfection, a loaf of golden bread, a slab of butter that positively gleamed. There were bunches of grapes and quarters of cheese, an apple tart hidden beneath a lattice of short-crust pastry. The sardines in the glass jar looked the most delectable of all. But it wasn't until Emil produced the jug of lemonade that Kathy realized none of it was real. Her eyes caught Emil's. "Please," he said, "just play." She picked up a bunch of painted grapes. They seemed almost good enough to eat. The adult part of her knew they were only orbs of wood, but another part could smell the crisp sweetness of the vineyard. The longer she held on to it, the more the feelings intensified. Just to test it further, she picked up a tiny teapot and pretended to pour a cup. The aisles that surrounded them fell away. She heard the tinkling of teaspoons, the drone of a dragonfly in the pristine parkland that now seemed to exist on the very edges of her vision. She could smell cake, buttery and rich with vanilla, though the only things beneath her fingers were paper and painted wood. She put the grapes and the teapot down, and the parkland evaporated. Suddenly she was back on the dusty shop floor. "It's incredible, Emil. Did you make all of this?" She looked up. While she had been engrossed, Emil had got to his feet. A few scant minutes ago his face had been open with pleasure. Now he prowled the edges of the picnic blanket like a scalded dog. If she had been expecting Emil to be heartened by her words, she was sorely disappointed. He simply picked up the cake, looked at it with disgust, and tossed it into the empty hamper. "I'm sorry, Kathy. I so wanted to give you a good day out. But play a little longer, you'll find ants in the sandwiches, storms in the sky." She ventured a grin, hoping it would dispel some of this madness. "Then you've captured the experience of almost every English picnic there's ever been?" If Emil appreciated the joke, he did not show it. He began to pack the hamper away, hands shaking in fury at the uselessness of a pinewood boiled egg. It isn't real. The feeling isn't right. Every cut I make, every little polish, it just slips further away. It starts out sunny and ends up with a storm. Why is that always the way? You're too cruel to yourself, Emil. I could taste the cake. Emil lost himself in the mania of packing his creation away. I'm working so hard, Kathy, but Caspar... What of him? It's those toy boxes of his. Why couldn't I... Why didn't I... If he perfects it by winter, Papa will be so proud. Kathy sighed, trying hard not to let her exasperation show. Does it matter? You don't understand. Papa, he's not a young man. Sometimes it seems like he never was. But he won't make toys forever. And when he stops, well, the Emporium, it has to belong, doesn't it? There has to be a Papa Jack. What if... Emil lost his words. Perhaps this was a fear to which he had never given voice. What if he decided that, because Caspar's toys, Emil, this is your home, he's your papa too? For a time, Emil remained silent. He toyed with a humble pork pie, balsa wood, cork and pine, and seemed lost in his imaginings of it. And only when he reared up did Kathy understand he'd been trembling all along, desperate to say something but uncertain if he dared say it. It wasn't always like this, when we were boys. Those first years when Papa showed us how, I'd make good things. Things every bit as good as Caspar's. Better, even. And if you don't believe me, all you have to do is look at the pictures. Just ask my Papa. When we were in our tenement, I made a sledge for the other boys to ride down Whitechapel Hill. It was so good, those street boys stole it in the end. They said they could feel the snow around them, even in summer. And there was my kite. It burst into flight like a Chinese dragon, so light and strong it couldn't come down. And it just flew there, in the skies above Weaver's Fields, until finally some men came up from the docks in St. Catherine's and set light to its tether. And then it just flew away, burning as it climbed into the sun. Or there were the first years we were here, in the Emporium, and Papa gave us a workshop and said, "Do your best, boys." And we did. All of my marching knights and pinwheels... My princesses in their towers. Oh, I wish I had one now, Kathy, and then you'd see. Then you'd see it wasn't always Caspar. He had to stop, but only for want of breath. Then there was that summer. You know how it happens. Caspar grew 6 inches in a night, and his voice was different, and he was growing his beard. And that was the summer, Kathy. That was the summer when... Emil... You don't have to say all this. Nobody's... One morning I woke up, and there he was, sitting at the end of my bed. I could tell he'd been up all night because he had that bedraggled look about him. That elated look in his eyes. He had it every time he'd made a new toy he wanted me to try out. Well, I was still weary, but nothing woke me up back then like the idea of a new toy. So Caspar put a pop-up book in my hands, and when I opened it, it just kept on opening. And suddenly there I was inside a jungle lair, with creepers and vines and monkeys swinging in the trees. And a little motor started spinning and a crackling voice came out. "What do you think of this, Emil? What do you think of this?" It was Caspar's voice and Caspar's toy, and that, Kathy, that was when I knew. I spent the rest of that summer trying to make a book just like his, but I never could do it. And it's been the same ever since. "No," he went on before she could console him any further, "don't try and persuade me. A toy box like Caspar's, it's worth as much as the whole of the Emporium. A hamper like mine, it might fill a few shelves, but will they talk about it on Speaker's Corner? Will children be jealous if their neighbour has one on Christmas morning?" "Tell me something, Emil. Why don't you do what you're good at? Not what Casper's good at, not what your papa's good at. What about you? What about your soldiers?
Yes, Emil said. I'll always have my soldiers, won't I?
And you said it yourself. They come to the Emporium to see wonders, and maybe they even buy those wonders too, but not like they buy your soldiers. How many toy boxes can Casper possibly make? 10? 12 if he doesn't sleep until first frost? Well, that's 12 customers at most. 12 times the bell rings with a sale. Now, just imagine how many of your soldiers are going to fly out of the door this Christmas. I saw the things you've been working on, remember? Imagine how excited boys are going to be this Christmas to play battles with soldiers who can rally and shoot. The transformation in Emil was almost physical. He grew bigger, stood taller.
Do you really think?
Treat yourself more kindly, Emil. That's an order. Emil nodded. Yes, Kathy thought, he likes being ordered around. And perhaps he would have marched away there and then, back to his workshop lathe and the hundreds more soldiers he might create before dawn. If only his eyes had not caught her hand hovering over her bump.
I tried to talk to Mrs. Hornung, but she hasn't had babies of her own, and I don't know where else to look. Mrs. Hornung said the body takes care of its own, and I suppose there must be something in that because... He stopped because he was blathering now. Are you afraid?
A little more each day.
It's no good me telling you not to be afraid. It isn't me who has to do it. Suppose you think I'm awfully selfish, coming to you with my toys, worrying about who will own the Emporium when...
No, Emil. She crossed the expanse and pressed her fingers to the back of his hand. I don't. It was the first time he had smiled all night.
I'd like to help you, when it happens. You mustn't be alone.
In her mind's eye, she saw Casper. Casper stroking the hair out of her eyes. Casper clutching her hand. The image was fleeting, but enough to make her snatch her own hand away.
I won't be.
Somewhere high above, a light exploded on one of the galleries circling the Emporium dome. Together they looked up. A figure had emerged. Even at this distance there was no mistaking Papa Jack. He moved with the slowness of glaciers. He crossed from one gallery to the next, and there he stopped, propped up on the balcony rail to look over the shop floor.
"He can't sleep again," said Emil.
"That means either he had an idea, or..." Papa Jack lifted himself to move again. Kathy was certain she was not mistaken. The old man was either crying or singing. Whichever it was, it had the quality of winter wind in the trees.
Or what?
Or he's remembering. High above, Papa Jack disappeared through another door. The light seemed to move sluggishly after him, as if he wore it as a bridal train. Emil must have realized he was standing too close to Kathy, for he swiftly stepped aside.
"I'll come back soon, Kathy. I'll make soldiers so magnificent those toy boxes will sit around gathering dust. This winter they won't even remember those paper trees."
Kathy watched him race off into the darkness of the shop floor. It was strange how easily Emil and Casper thought of the first frost, of October and November and Christmas beyond. Kathy laid a hand on her belly, where the baby was suddenly too big to cartwheel around. Before winter, there was autumn. And before autumn, summer. No wonder she could not envisage beyond. For what was life going to look like then? The weeks flickered by. Keeping Casper from Emil and Emil from Casper became a parlour game in which all three of them were embroiled, though only Kathy had any knowledge of the rules. When Casper was inside the Wendy House walls, the baby tumbled in panic. For what would happen were Emil to come sauntering through the paper trees right then? When Emil came by to show her the Cossack cavalry he was devising, the miniature cannonade and musketeers fit for the Crimea, the baby tumbled again. For what if there were to come a knock at the door and Kathy were to open it, only to discover a perfectly composed toy box out of which Caspar Godman unfolded himself. There were tricks she learnt to employ. The gifts Emil brought could be hidden at the bottom of Caspar's toy box. The signs of Caspar's visit were easier to disguise, for he brought only his ideas. And the only sign he was there were the teacups he left behind, the impression his body made on the bed when he lay back, and told her how one day he would make her a Wendy house 10 times the size. A paper garden for her baby, a whole world they need never leave. And perhaps it was the way her eyes furrowed at this that prompted Caspar's return at dawn the next morning. Evidently he had slept, for he looked less ragged than Kathy had seen him in weeks. He wore a woolen town coat, and over his shoulder a satchel of waxed leather. "You'll have to come quickly, if this is going to work." Still in her nightdress, Kathy felt suddenly naked. "If what's going to work?" "You've been a prisoner too long, Miss Ray. This emporium of ours has its wonders, but sometimes you need a moment of normality to remember the magic. What do you say?"
"I'd say something, if only I knew what..."
"Outside, Miss Ray. London. But it has to be now, because once Emil starts pottering around the shop floor, the moment is lost. Seize the day, Miss Ray." It was not the idea of seizing the day that propelled her to rush behind the screen and scramble into her day clothes. It was the thought of Emil wending his way down here to share the fruits of his evening's endeavour and catching her with Caspar. For Emil, that would be a calamity too terrible to bear. She was, after all, his secret. Hastily dressed, she stepped out from behind the screen and slipped her arm through Caspar's. "Do you know," she said, "it's somehow hard to think of there being an outside at all." "It can get you like that," said Caspar, and with a wolfish grin he led her through the shadowed halls. The coach was waiting at the end of Iron Duke Mews, with a horse already reined in. At first Kathy took it for patchwork, but it was only the enforced months of the Emporium tricking her eyes. This horse was very real. Caspar helped Kathy onto the stage, where she sat among great felt sacks bulging with presents. She recognised sets of Emile's soldiery spilling out, boxes of paper trees, a floating cloud castle weighted down so that it did not disappear up above the London streets. "What is all this?" "There's a city to explore," Caspar began, "but we have to earn it first. Come on, I'll show you." The sun was not fully risen as Caspar drove the coach into the winding streets of Soho, but by the time they reached the Cambridge Circus it was lighting them in radiant array. Kathy had quite forgotten the temptations of sunshine. She felt brighter already. Outside the Palace Theatre, where a gaggle of stagehands called out to Caspar as he passed, "I used to come down here sometimes. The men in these theatres, they think they know magic. Don't tell Papa, but I leased them serious one season. They taught him stage tricks. They're the reason he can perform a tightrope walk." They stopped to buy oranges, and with their fingers sticky with juice, they wended their way south, down the Charing Cross Road into the banks of the river. There were places he wanted to take her. Somewhere there was a pokey little toy shop that specialised in miniatures. They were not without merits, Caspar said, as long as you could overlook the fact that all they did was sit there looking small. But better were the places he used to visit, secret places of his own. The Emporium might be the world, but summers there are long, Miss Ray. Sometimes you want something else. I tried to bring Emil once. I had to put a halter on him just to get him out of the door. I forfeited 2 rounds in our long war just to make sure he wouldn't tell Papa. But Emil never did like escaping the Emporium. I don't think he's set foot outside in 3 whole years. Escaping from the Emporium seemed such a strange thing to hear Caspar speaking about. She wondered how often he slipped through the tradesmen's exits, what life he found out here, what people he knew. It was on her mind to ask when the river hove into view, and hanging above it, the Houses of Parliament, the Abbey standing proudly behind. She had seen them in miniature on the Emporium shelves, but there they were, blotting out the skyline. How vast the world really was when you started looking up. Caspar drove the coach out over the river, and for a time they lingered there, the boats turning underneath. She breathed in the ripe tang of the Thames and wondered that she was even alive. Sir Josiah sat beyond the railway arches and the Lambeth Bridge, a tumble-down of brick buildings arrayed around a yard with wooden outhouses in between. It sat in shadow at the end of a row of buildings that looked bleaker still. The yard that sat in front was pitted with potholes where thistles and nettles burst up in inglorious rapture. Casper brought the truck to a halt and, leaping down, extended a hand to guide down Kathy. "What is this place?" In reply, the doors opened and across the narrow yard out tumbled a horde of children. The elder ones stampeded the younger in their clamour to get past. Two of the grubbiest fought each other for the privilege of unlocking the iron gates, but once they had, nothing, not even the barking of the mistress who had appeared in the doorway behind them, could hold back the tide. Children of all shapes and sizes, not one of them wearing clothes that fit, lapped around the wagon. Casper slid blinkers over his horse's eyes, if only to stop his restless shifting. "Think of it as the summer emporium," Casper began, and upon lifting the first of the felt sacks from the coach floor, submitted himself to the whirlwind of grasping hands as the children closed in. After it was done, and the coach floor empty, Kathy watched the children tumble in orgies of delight around the yard, running wind-up armies against each other, squabbling for the affection of the litter of patchwork kittens they had awoken from their slumber, or clinging tight to the floating cloud castles for fear they might evaporate away. For some time, Casper was locked in conversation with Sir Josiah's schoolmistress. Why this should have bothered Kathy, she had no idea, save for the fact that this particular mistress had a prim beauty about her. Only when he had finished did he saunter back through the gates and join her at the wagon. Inside the yard, the battles went on. One of the patchwork kittens was already stuck, mewing for help from the top of a paper tree. "Do you do this every year?" "Once a summer. It stops one feeling stifled." He paused, reappraising himself. "Don't look at me like that, Miss Ray. I'll admit, I enjoy the adoration." "I know you do. Does it make me awfully selfish?" Kathy was puzzled. "To hand out toys at an abandoned children's home?" "To bask in the glow of it." A thought cascaded over Kathy, one from which she could not escape. For mightn't her own child, the one squirming in her belly, have started its life in a place like this? Might it not be its face pressed against the window, waiting for a visit, from the emporium, from a grieving family, from an old spinster desperate for a baby of her own? I think selfishness of that kind might be forgiven. Casper. And here she hesitated, thinking she might take his hand. "Can we? Back to the emporium?" "Not that." She tried to lift herself onto the coach again, but her body resisted. She felt the touch of Casper's hands as he helped her aboard. "But not here." "I believe that's a thing we might do, Miss Ray." Sometime later, having first explored the flower markets of Covent Garden, Casper accompanied Kathy through the Marble Arch and walked her arm in arm into the budding green of Hyde Park. It was unseasonably bright, and the sunshine had already lured countless clerks out of their offices. Most were picnicking around the Apsley Gate, where handsome columns framed a frieze of charioteers riding out to war. Kathy could not ignore the furrowed looks as they noted the roundness of her belly. But it was not this that made her follow Casper on. She was, after all, used to a little scorn. Soon they reached a stand of trees grown in such contortions that they seemed crowned in roots, growing down into the earth. Here patients from the hospital on the Hyde Park corner formed a great horseshoe, fresh London air being deemed beneficial to their health. And even one of these, an elderly lady clinging to a velveteen rabbit from the emporium stores, acknowledged Casper as he passed. "They're looking at me, aren't they?" Kathy asked. Together they found the shade above the serpentine and looked out across its glittering expanse. "Let them look. They'll think I'm the servant girl you've taken as your bride." "Have they never seen a woman with child before?" "You said it yourself, Casper. I'm 16, if I'm a day." "You've never cared before?" "I don't care now," she answered, though perhaps it was no longer true. The Wendy house had spoiled her. It would have been like this every day had she stayed at home. There came the sound of a motor car approaching along the rotten row, a trail of horse-drawn carriages trotting in its wake. Casper turned away from them with a sigh. I'd rather a runnerless rocking horse than a real horse almost any day. At least the stupidity of his sneer plucked her out of her own thoughts. Have you ever ridden one? I could make a patchwork horse twice as comfortable. Give it a little thought and I could make one twice as fast. As if to prove a point, he darted for the roots behind him, came back with a fistful of twigs and lengths of dried grass, and set about meshing them in his lap. A few moments later, he set down a cavalry horse of sticks and made it canter toward her. Once it was in her lap, she held it aloft. It was only the sketch of a horse, and yet every muscle was demarked in dead grass. Its halter was thistle, its mane made out of clover. There was silence, punctured only by the riot of ducks on the water. The gentlemen from the motor car had launched a punt and were helping their shrieking lady friends aboard. Kathy set the horse back down, tweaked its tail, and watched it canter to Casper. Moments later, he turned it back toward her. Each time it made the crossing, it frayed apart a little further. Each time it lurched over a diminishing length of grass. And as they passed it back and forth, Kathy's hands crept closer to Casper's own. At last, when the horse was spent, Casper's fingers touched hers. He wants to kiss me now, thought Kathy. And even as certain as he is, vain and cocksure as ever, I'd let him. But the baby had sensed something. It moved inside her, suddenly the only thing she could feel, the ripples across her insides, the ridge that moved across her belly. She had waited too long. Masking his pain, Casper whipped his hand away, began tying knots in the grasses at his feet. Home, he said. Something inside her wanted to say more. There was so much with which that silence might have been filled. And yet... Home, she finally replied. By the time they returned to the Emporium, dusk was already settling. What clerks and day trippers had swarmed Hyde Park were turning back to their townhouses and lodgings. At the end of Iron Duke Mews, the Emporium was a box of delights forgotten at Christmas and secreted away until the snow next fell. There was something forlorn about the idea that these isles never saw summer. Casper said so little as they made their way back to the isles. He was hurt, that much he could tell. He had every right to be. He had told her so much. Of the time before their papa, of the crossing they had made, of that wretched tenement where they had lived. All that he wanted was for her to say a little of her own life. Why, then, did it seem so hard? He took her as far as the paper trees, but would go no further. As she watched him go, something implored her to follow. And yet she remained, her feet stuck as fast as the roots of the trees that surrounded her. Sirius did not rush out to join her. That would have been some consolation for whatever it was she was feeling, but as she stepped through the Wendy House door, she realized why. The dog was curled up at the foot of the bed, and pinned to his breast was a simple letter. I missed you. Where are you? Yours always, Emile. She clasped the letter to her breast, pitched down onto the bed and lay there as Sirius scrabbled up beside her. She was tired, yet thoughts of Casper kept cartwheeling through her mind, and the baby was pressed up against her, shifting in places that made her think the time was near. Where had this heaviness come from? It ought to have been a joyous day, she and Casper out in the world, and yet... She sat up. I've let him down, haven't I? The paper tore where her fingers were straining at it. Come on, Sirius. You can lead the way. She stopped outside the door to Emile's workshop. Part of her hoped he wasn't there. But no, there he was, as besotted with his work as Casper before him. He had fallen asleep where he was sitting, slumped over his lathe with a unit of half-formed soldiers lined up in the vice. Gone were the half-formed patchworks he had been trying to make, gone his attempts at recreating Emporium instant trees, gone the chaos of splintered parts that had put Kathy in mind of a child at tantrum. As hard as she looked, she could not even see the picnic hamper over which he had shed so many tears. Now, the workshop was in